session number 21279, Real Fool.
Cyril Williams, Real Four. So what did the actual training comprise of then at Fargo?
Well, an extraordinary and ridiculous amount of being drilled like guardsmen, and we weren't being prepared for guardsmen, and I thought it was nonsensical, and in fact confessed as much when I was asked during part of the training. I think the chap was a psychologist before he was commissioned, and he said, after offering me a cigarette and getting me to settle down, "Tell me what you honestly think about the discipline here in the training." And I said, "Well, frankly, I think it's a load of rubbish." And he didn't give away, you know, that I'd virtually cut my own throat. And I really think I was given a tough time. In fact, I remember our sergeant major, he came in one Saturday night and he threw his belt and gaiters and he said, "Do these and do them thoroughly." And I think, might be wrong, but I think in a way he was wondering if that's going to be the last straw, because he could see that I was not enthusiastic at that stage. Everything physical that they demanded of me, I mean, I did like the others, but this was without enthusiasm, because I thought, well, we're not being drilled for the ballet or the guards. So, but the training, and then these were assault courses, you know, extraordinary, really. And in fact, I still meet this man. There were two instructors there. One lives in Weston and was a decent bloke, but the other one was a shocker. I meet him from time to time, and he turned out good glider pilot. So, but we had to scramble up a wooden wall, logged wall, which wasn't easy, and then we'd to jump down on the other side. We couldn't see what there was because smoke grenades had been chucked, but we were told that it was a pit crisscrossed with barbed wire, and so if you jumped down, and it must have been maybe 12 feet jumped down, you'd get cut at the very least, and then plastic or clay grenades were thrown in there. And I thought, and still think, that I wonder if they got anyone blinded by these things being chucked down into the smoke. And then you'd to scramble through this, and you did have tattered denims when you, you know, finished that, and really your knees were bleeding a little bit because it couldn't be avoided. Lots of exercises, and then if you got through that, and there are a lot of people still claim that that was worse than Arnhem, although a lot of the older pilots, they'd trained at Tidworth, and they claim that their training there was worse than ours at Fargo. Well, I don't know. But then, and this was the great part, this is the part that I liked, there was flying training and Tiger Moths or Miles Magisters. For some lucky ones, they were both. And then after getting through that, a few people were failed, you know, because they couldn't manage the flying. They hadn't the dexterity. And then we went on Hotspur. This was 8-seater gliders. That's where I met the Colonel Fryer, the one who insisted that we would throw the Bren away, and that, you know, the rifle is the British soldier's weapon. So.
So how long did all this training take?
Fargo was probably just another maybe 2 months. And then you move to an EFTS, Elementary Flying Training School, for the powered flying. And then to Stoke Orchard, which is not too far from Cheltenham.
I know it well, yeah. So after Fargo, after your 8 weeks there, you went to an Elementary Flying Training School, which
yes.
is where?
Well, I was officially at Booker, but I was at the satellite aerodrome, which was Denham. Sir Alexander Calder's private field, it had been. And in fact, when we were coming in to land there, you would also see, in fact, there was a set of a merchant ship that was sinking, something being made for a ministry thing. And incongruously, there were Roman soldiers strolling along there. So it must have been another film.
So what was it like at Booker then, Denham?
It was great.
Yeah. What sort of a camp was it?
Well, I think we were in part of the house there. And I know the place, we went in nicely panelled places. But I didn't finish my training there because it was January, and of course the weather's a bit dodgy.
This would be January, which year?
44 would be. And then, because I went solo on Valentine's Day, but it wasn't at Denham because of the poor weather, I suppose. The flying training was not passing as many, you know, fledgling pilots as it should have done. So 12 of us were moved to Cliff Piperd, which is near Swindon, not far from the motorway.
Sorry, Cliff?
Cliff Piperd. C-L-Y-F-F-E, I think, and then Piperd, P-Y-P-A-R-D. And this was, we were the only 12... army trainee pilots there, because the function of the airfield was for RAF grader courses. It was for people who were of the standard for either pilot or observer, and those who did better with the flying training proceeded in pilot training. But so we were a bit of a rarity, and as we were fitter than any of these RAF people, we were given the job of taking the RAF people out on run marches, which they did not like. And anyway, I mean, that was very good. So,
how long were you at Cliff Piperd?
I really don't know, because it would only be a matter of weeks, because it's the flying hours that's the thing. I mean, I know there's elementary navigation being given, and the fact that, well, we were kept fit by running these RAF people about.
Did you feel inferior to the people who were doing the full pilot training?
No.
Rather than being glider pilot?
No. No. Well, its controls are fewer, but most of us did 100 hours in flying hours in a Tiger Moth, or another appropriate light aircraft. But really. No, I certainly didn't feel inferior. In fact, I think probably we felt superior at that point because we were bright enough, and I, had it not been for this defective colour vision, I would have gone through, you see. And in fact, most of the people who'd applied for the glider pilot regiment, it was formed in 1942. So the early volunteers would be those who had been accepted for RAF training,
right,
but had not been allowed to proceed.
Yeah.
So there was no feeling of inferiority. In fact, because we were elite soldiers by then. We, you know, by virtue of the physical training, and well, if in fact you'd failed the flying training, like a friend of mine from Western, instead of RTUing or being RTUed, returning to unit, you could elect to go to the parachute regiment. Now, it didn't guarantee you a place, but because you'd got that far on the glider pilot training, then it would be unlikely that you'd be failed. And, well, this chap who lived in Weston till he died a few weeks ago, he said he was with the 21st Independent Parachute Company. Now, these were the Pathfinders, and although my unit, F Squadron, was provided the first gliders to go down at Arnhem, because the glider force secured the landing zones for the main para force. In fact, more people were taken down by glider than by parachute. In fact, we get rather peeved when we read of the para landings, you know, there. But anyway, Alan said to me, well, a long time ago, he said, most of us are failed GPs and, you know, glider pilots. And the fact that they were with the elite paras. So certainly, I know I'm labouring the points, but it's thinking, what idea? Did we feel inferior?
No.
Right.
No. You knew exactly where you were. So what sort of gliders were you learning on? And how, tell me how your first lesson went, if you could.
Well, I'd always been keen on flying. I'd been... anyway, this is... It'll be, you know, hours going on. But my father had been a pilot. He'd moved from the Warder Regiment to the Royal Flying Corps, and then he became a commercial pilot for a period after the war. He's got one of the earliest B licences, which was the name for the commercial pilot licence then. He also took the first airmail to Egypt with second pilot was Campbell Black, who was married to... Oh, I need my wife to prod at the moment. But she was a film star of the day. But anyway...
early lessons.
Early lessons. Well, once you'd shown the delicacy of touch, if I think I must put it like that, to fly a light aircraft... and it is delicate touch, then it needs heftier handling of a military glider. The first one we started on was the not to be confused with these graceful sailplanes, which have also flown after the war. But it was an 8-seater, 2 pilots and 6 crew, which means it was a foolish thing, you know, too wasteful. But 2 pilots tandem. And, well, there was an instructor, and again, there were still RAF pilots. And then you sat in the behind position, because when you fly solo, that's the position that you're in. It gets the correct trim, you know, the balance of the thing. So I think it was only about... maybe 15 hours there. But I was at Stoke Orchard, and it was marvellous. I still delight when I think of going over here, places like this, you see, and Cheltenham, and seeing, you know, the Cotswolds from the air. It was lovely. Yeah. And you were towed for much of the time, because a lot of people think that, well, you're doing nothing... but if you were to fly hands off, the thing would flutter about like a kite. Yeah. And in fact, it would, if the glider, the towing aircraft rather, didn't release, it would be in real trouble. Yeah. But...
you were, excuse my ignorance, you were pulled up into the air behind
yes.
a light aircraft. Which aircraft?
Well, not so very light then, because the... the glider itself, like an eight-seater, although we just had two people in, it was, I think it was a Harvard tug. So it's really a powerful single engine thing. But when I went on the heavy glider conversion unit, the glider, the standard battle glider, was the Horsa, and that's 28 men plus two pilots, or it was a Jeep and a small field gun, or a howitzer, an American howitzer. You know, it's quite a load, and a single engine aircraft can't take you off, so it's either a bomber like a Halifax, or for nearly all of my training, it was being towed by a Dakota. Excuse me a minute, please.
Yeah, of course. So, these military gliders were quite significant beasts, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yep. So they took a bit of flying, because when you say glider, my first impression was...
It was a little sailplane. Yes.
That you've seen people.
Yep. There was a bigger glider, the Hamilcar, which I never flew, and that would take... this is back to the... the tanks again. There was an airborne glider, the Tetrarch, I think it was called. I've never seen one, but it must be clad in the sort of stuff that Bren gun carriers were clad in. It would take a weight of, I'm not sure whether it was 8 tonne maximum or 12, but the tank people that you'll deal with, or the archives there, they would have the technical details of the Tetrarch. I think that is the name of the glider.
Can you tell me a bit about one of the gliders you flew? You know, what the controls were like. I don't suppose there's many of them left, and we'd love to know what they were actually like to fly, what the controls were like, and procedures.
Well, it has all the basic controls of a powered aircraft, except for the ones dealing with the engine, of course.
Can you describe a particular glider, you know, a particular type?
There are twin flying wheels. The Horsa, I'm just looking and trying to imagine this as the... I'm just wondering if I've got any pictures of the... controls, but anyway, you've got one seat there on the left for the first pilot. You've got another one here for the second, and you've got an altimeter. You've got a compass. You've got probably about 9 basic controls. And plus one that the power pilots would never have heard of, the angle of dangle. And this is, if you're flying through cloud, then you lose the image of your tug aircraft. And this is most important, because if you've lost your image of the tow aircraft, then you can... first of all, get him to wallow about, because of the weight of the glider, and because of the increased drag of the glider, they're really flying not much more than the point of stall. In fact, it ruins the engines of even the four-engined Halifax. It would wallow. So the angle of dangle, it shows you what position you're at, because you could fly the high toe position, or which was the one commonly used. Yeah. In other words, you're higher than the slipstream of the two engines, which it is, for the battle gliders, or the low toe position, which is... well, it was described as periscope height, where you're flying below the turbulence created by the backflow of the engines. Yeah. But
could you cross over through the slipstream?
Yes, you could. But you've got to really well, both pilots have really got to hang on, because there's a great deal of turbulence then, and it's not a place where you'd stay for long because of the turbulence, and because it's not doing the glider any good. I didn't know of one breaking up, although I knew of one where, when he was doing practicing a dive approach, that is, like pulling off, you know, at several thousand feet, getting down as steeply and as quick as you can, and then, before you crash, you know, into the ground, pull the wheel, you always call it the stick, pulling it back. And when this was tried by one chap, the tail piece came off, so of course he did go straight in. But oh, I've got some pictures somewhere. I know I've described it not very well.
No, you have, yeah. So what were the sort of pre-flight checks? I mean, did you have any communication with the tug?
Yes. You've got, I think it was 100-yard hemp rope, and it's coupled. You've got like a Y coupling. The front is at the rear of the tug aircraft, and then on the leading edges of the glider, you've got two big couplings. They're about the size of a man's fist that fit in metal things, heavy metal things. And, well, the tug aircraft goes rumbling along the, it's usually a runway. Sometimes it's just like a grassed airfield, like, well, Netherhaven, which I flew from a time, and it pleases me because my father talked about Netherhaven in the First World War. But
so when you're rumbling along, are you talking to the tug pilot?
Ah, yes, that was your question. I wondered. Yeah, there's a wire going through, you know, that's the hemp thing bound in, so you can speak, and there is too. Well, sometimes radio communication, but all the ones that I were in just had this telephone system. And
so was there quite a lot of chat?
No. The only chat would be if it was a newish pilot, you would get an irate voice coming, you know, you're tugging me up and down, and, you know, if you go on like this, I'll have to release you. Because you can release from the tug aircraft, but normally we release at our end, which is the sensible thing. We know what's happening, because once you release, you've, well, it's not like a powered aircraft. If you're not making a proper approach, you open up the throttles and go around again. If you start, if you disengage, then you've obviously got a limited number of choices. So it was very exciting, lively.
So it sounds sort of, to someone who knows nothing, as though there actually, it was a more difficult job than flying a powered aircraft.
Well,
got lots of other factors.
It's a more concentrated period when you're on free flight, but no, the pilots who were drafted in while I was a prisoner, and they hadn't got enough glider pilots left, you know, to do any other operations, as there was one, the Rhine crossing into Germany proper, but they were more competent, more skilled pilots, because they'd got the hours on, and the dual engined experience that we never had and never needed, of course.
But so how much training did you do then before you went into action? I mean, how many hours?
Well,
or flying time, I should say.
Well, probably not enough. In fact, the wings that I was presented, they offended me, and still do, actually. They gave me second pilot's wings because we were, and it was this desperate rush to get enough pilots for D-Day, you know, the second front and any other excursions, you know, from then on. But it annoys me because, as I say, I did all second pilots, did all that was expected of us. We didn't get the hours in, but that wasn't our fault. I mean, they'd obviously started the training too late. And so that, anyway.
How much of an idea did you have of what you were being trained for?
Oh, a very good idea, because, I mean, seeing the pictures of the Germans, well, from German newsreels, the landing in Belgium, where they put a crack force and, I suppose, they were able to leap over the Maginot Line. Not that that seemed to be any good, you know, by itself. But, again, Crete, where a German force took over the island, and, well, I don't know the relative numbers of our force plus New Zealanders, I think, and the German invading force. But again, because they were airborne troops, I would imagine, well, they must have been elite troops. Because, I mean, it's one thing to be an ordinary infantryman. I'm not wanting to denigrate the infantry, but if you get people who are volunteering to be placed in the hot spots, and particularly if it's an airborne force, like we at Arnhem, there were three great water barriers, the Rhine, the Maas, and a big canal, and we were 60 miles in enemy territory. So if anything had gone wrong, as did go wrong, the two American divisions who invaded, you know, more southerly, we were in trouble, as proved to be. Yeah. But
how much, while you were doing this training, did you follow the progress of the war through the newsreels and the newspapers or the radio?
Oh, a great deal. And listen to this thing. We were on I think we'd just qualified as glider pilots, and we went to London, about six of us, and we stayed at the Royal Armoured Club, because I said, I know a good thing, and, you know, ex-tanky, so along there we went. But the RAC Club is not far from Grosvenor Square, and it was not far from the American Embassy then and now, and there were WACs, the women troops. Now, I'd be 20 then, but there's a big gap between 20 and, say, a woman soldier of maybe 24. It's an enormous gap, really. But anyway, we got to know, as is not too difficult, you know, in wartime, and we went to the theatre, the cinema, with these people, and it was fine, except that they were a bit embarrassed at the number of times some of our people were excusing themselves, you know, to go to the loo. But there was a newsreel. I don't know what the main film was, but the newsreel I remember very well. It showed returning prisoner of war from an exchange were on there, and people had lost arms, legs, blinded, people being carried down on stretchers. And I remember that then it was a combined Red Cross and St. John. They came along, the lights went up a little bit, and I was fumbling in my pocket to see, you know, a suitable coin, but not too big a coin, you know, to put into the box. And I remember, you know, one of the men who died at St. Arnhem, he said, "Don't be bloody stingy, Williams." He said, "You know, this might help you sometime," as it did later. And anyway, whether I put a half a crown in or what. But anyway.
So you were well aware.
I was well aware. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I got the last prisoner of war exchange of the war. So I was only a prisoner for 4 months, you know, which was long enough.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there. Cyril Williams, end of reel 4.